NBC News Radio. I'm Mike Vaccara. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton blasting Syrian President Bashar al-Assad at a 60-nation summit in Turkey today. She's also bolstering support for the Syrian opposition. NBC's Andrea Mitchell is traveling with the secretary.
There were complaints from the Syrian opposition leaders that the U.S. and the rest of the world has not done enough. Secretary Clinton told them that they will be getting more aid. She has now pledged communications gear to the rebels to help them organize.
Emergency services and embassy officials are preparing help for 1,000 people on a partially disabled cruise ship headed for a Malaysian port after a fire left it adrift at sea for 24 hours. The Azamara Quest was stranded in southern Philippine waters after a fire engulfed one of its engine rooms Friday night. Coast Guard rescuers are expected to parachute down to a racing yacht damaged in a storm that injured three crew members off California's coast. This is NBC News Radio. The Vatican and the Holy Land mark Palm Sunday today, the kickoff to Holy Week leading to Easter Sunday. Pope Benedict celebrated Mass in St. Peter's Square while pilgrims in Jerusalem retraced the route Jesus took to make his entry into the city. A new study may have children cheering. A group of Australian researchers at Sydney University say piling on the homework doesn't help kids do better in school. NBC's Rahima Ellis says the group came up with these guidelines.
Some experts recommend the 10-minute per grade rule. For a third grader, about 30 minutes. For a sixth grader, no more than an hour. For older students, it depends on their coursework.
New information is contradicting earlier reports that said no illegal drugs were found in the hotel room where Whitney Houston died. TMZ.com says official documents show police recovered white powdery remnants from the scene and that the powder was tested and identified as cocaine. More news at MSNBC.com. I'm Mike Vaccara, NBC News Radio.
Imagine two identical cars. One has been continuously filled with low-detergent gasoline. The other with BP gasoline with Invigorate. When used continuously, it helps clean and protect critical engine parts from harmful deposits, which can help it go a little farther between fill-ups than a car that continuously uses low-detergent gas. Now imagine both cars driving down the highway. Which one could go a little farther? BP gasoline with Invigorate. Imagine that.
State Farm, this is Jessica.
Hello, Jessica. Jerry Newman calling. How much could I save by combining auto and home policies?
Well, you could save over $750, but remember you dropped us?
Bummer, because I just combined my auto and home.
Jerry, did you miss the garage again?
The garage door and the front door look so similar.
Save an average of $750 when you bundle your auto and home policies with State Farm. Get to a better state. Call 1-800-STATE-FARM today. Average household savings based on 2010 National Survey of New Policyholders reported savings by...
Hey everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
Join us next Sunday, April 1st. We won't be fooling around too much, but we will have the wines of Paso Robles in studio. They're coming in for a huge event. And have you been to Mintwood Place yet? If you haven't, you're going to hear all about it here.
I got that April 1st joke. That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday and every Sunday live at 11 right here on 1500 AM.
I love my husband, but I didn't realize our difficulties had to do with his drinking. Our pastor suggested I go to Al-Anon family groups. I didn't think I would be comfortable, but I decided to try a meeting. The Al-Anon meeting really opened my eyes. Are you troubled by someone's drinking? You might be surprised at what you could learn in an Al-Anon family group meeting from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-Al-Anon.
My advice to you, until they upgrade the system, simply turn off PhotoStream on your iPhone the next time you're in Vegas, and then it doesn't go anywhere.
Okay.
Or else, change your Vegas behavior, or else, don't take pictures while you're in Vegas. So now, once you've deleted all the photos in the PhotoStream, you've got to then go to the camera roll and delete those individuals.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
It's about smiles. It's about laughter. It's about going out and making a difference in the life of a child. You don't have to get mad. You just have to go mad. GoMad2011.com is a website dedicated to supporting the Make-A-Wish Foundation. At GoMad, our mission is simple, to go out and make a difference. So how can you help? Visit the Wish Wall on GoMad2011.com and make a contribution today. Or find out how you can donate with a simple text message. Do it now so that we can continue to touch the lives of children with life-threatening conditions by granting their wishes.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Phil Horeggi of Sabre Systems and Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And we have a fantastic lineup of guests for you today, including Bruce Caswell, who is President and General Manager of the Health Services segment, Maximus. Also, John Abeles, Founder, President, and CEO of System One. Gore Bolton, Founder and CEO of Bolton Brands, and Maria Proestu, Co-Founder, President, and CEO of Delta Resources. So let's get the show started. We'd like to introduce to you our first guest. His name is Bruce Caswell. Bruce is the President and General Manager of the Health Services segment, Maximus. So Bruce, welcome to the show, and tell us, what is the Health Services segment of Maximus?
Well, I'll begin by telling you a little bit about Maximus. Maximus is a billion-dollar company with operations around the world, and in the most simplest form, we help individuals find jobs, and we help individuals get health benefits or health insurance through public benefit programs. The health segment of Maximus is focused on that latter part.
So how do you do that?
Well, we are an administrative contractor, if you will, so we're involved at the front end of that process. We help individuals apply for and be determined eligible for public health benefit programs like the Medicaid program and the Children's Health Insurance Program. We serve about 19 million Americans through the services we provide in 14 states.
Why is this such important work, Bruce?
This is important for a number of reasons. The first being that the low to moderate income population in America is substantial, and certainly with the economic downturn of recent years, that population has only grown. Also, under health reform, the Medicaid population will expand substantially, 16 million more Americans on Medicaid. It's an important set of supports for Americans.
Why is it so challenging for one of your clients, if you will, to do this on their own, as opposed to needing to come to you and help them with this?
It's never easy when you've got a lot on your plate, and you may also have challenges related to cultural or linguistic capacity that make difficult applications for health insurance or benefits tough to navigate. So it's helpful for individuals to have others to turn to help them through that process and explain the benefits. For many Americans, their first experience with health insurance will be under health reform.
How'd you get into the business?
How did Maximus get into the business, or me? Well,
you.
That's a great question. I have really for a long time had a passion for the programs that help the less fortunate in America with not just health insurance benefits, but also nutritional assistance. And as I took my first job out of graduate school, I worked for Price Waterhouse, and I did government services consulting, much of which was focused on the food stamp program and the supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children, also known as the WIC program. That's how I got my, I think, early passion for these programs in this population.
Let's go back to the very beginning of your life. You were almost born in an airplane, were you not?
Well, that's somewhat true. I was the son of a Foreign Service officer, and my father worked both at the U.S. State Department during the Johnson administration, but we were also stationed overseas in Senegal and Tunisia. And indeed, I was fortunate to be born in Washington, D.C., and spent my formative years in upstate New York, in central New York.
But your mom was pregnant in Africa, and they flew her over here. So you could be born on U.S. soil.
Well, and I think that it's more a function of wanting to ensure good medical care than necessarily ensuring the ability to one day become president.
Is there any significant impact on your life with having a father who was a diplomat in the Foreign Service?
Yes, my father, really in everything he did from a young age, imbued in me values of respect for the individual, an appreciation for diversity and multiculturalism, and really the diplomacy aspect is an ability and needing to understand both sides, if you will, of an argument, both sides of a position, and really to be a good listener.
Is that basically where your sense of advocacy also comes from, too? Like, you know, giving a voice to those who may not necessarily have a strong voice for their own?
I think that's the case. I grew up in, I would say, a middle-class household, but there were times, like in many people's lives, when you knew as a family we were struggling, and I had many, growing up in a rural part of upstate New York, I had many friends who I knew were dependent on public assistance programs, and I think that helped shape the early development of my appreciation and a passion in public policy, and as a consequence, when I went to graduate school, I did a master's in public policy rather than an MBA, which was a conscious decision.
That background you just described, did that have anything to do with, as a paper boy, quote, you were out to get every account on the street, end quote?
I was always a self-starter, and yes, I was entrepreneurial from an early age. But interestingly, unlike many of your other guests, you know, never started my own company, after my education, but rather have always tried to manage in an entrepreneurial manner in larger companies.
Well, your father is political, but you're in the entrepreneurial business. How does that mesh?
My father, it's interesting. My father, in addition to his background as a diplomat, was a university administrator, college administrator, and professor. And I think I probably learned from his career as an administrator about the operations of large organizations, the role of the public sector and the private sector. And I really have always had a desire to, in a way, ensure that I'm having an impact on public benefit programs and public sector business in general while operating in a private sector model.
I understand that you're a distance runner. Where did your interest in that start?
Well, I think like many folks, when you reach a point in your life where you may have been consuming more calories than you're expending, and you tip the scales a little bit more than you like, that comes into focus. But I will say my passion for that began with just an athletic background in collegiate soccer and a passion for running shorter distance races. But I found at one point that I just saw that as the next challenge and grasped it. And, you know, 25 marathons and ultramarathons later, it's part of my life.
Well, you certainly have a build for being a runner. You look like a runner. You're tall. You're thin. You look athletic. You were always this way?
Not always. There was certainly times when I probably had, I'm trying to think of the politically correct term, a different form factor, alternate body image. So certainly this is something, I would say the importance of that decision in my life is that I think, like many people would attest, when you have limited time to spend and you have to be well organized and you want to keep up a training regimen, like many athletes, it helps focus your work on your business side too.
So I guess to be direct, you were overweight at one point. Is that correct?
My wife would say it's the only time in her life that she's actually had to say something to me. So you're right.
And you made a decision to change.
Yes.
And that led to you running ultramarathons.
That's right.
How does that happen? I mean, lots of people, they go on diets or they may go to the gym. You went from zero to, you know, infinity. Why or how?
I knew at the time that it was more than just the physical challenge. It's the mental challenge. And I feel like that's, in many cases, the discipline of staying focused and getting through a race is about the mental challenge of it. And that, I think, is beneficial to a productive work life, too.
What's the difference between an ultra marathon and a marathon?
I'm told that technically anything longer than a marathon is an ultra marathon. So a 50K, which is 30 miles, or a 50 miler, or a 100 miler, they all fall into the ultra category.
And the longest race you've run is?
I've done 3 50 milers.
Wow. And what's that like?
Not by the way, consecutively.
No pun intended, but put us in your shoes. Running a marathon, the mental, an ultra marathon, the mental part of it, what's going on?
Well, the best way I've found to run a race like that is to kind of achieve a balance between the physical exertion, certainly the hydration and energy that you're taking in, and the mental presence or mental focus, if you will. And so what's going on is, first of all, it's helpful to have a great running partner. And I have several, but one in particular with whom I've done many of these races, and it makes the miles pass a lot faster. And you can talk about an awful lot of interesting things. So I'll tell you, it's the race is broken up into many parts, but you probably rely on your mental fortitude more in the middle miles than at the beginning or the end.
Can you describe a little bit how some of that mental focus and the commitment in running marathons and ultra marathons helps you in your work with Maximus? What does it bring to you in your work life?
Well, I think that you've actually put it quite well. There's focus and commitment that you need to have in your work, that you have in your personal life as well. I would also say the other dimension is the human dimension. Through physical activities like running, and folks have other physical pursuits, whether they're doing yoga or playing sports on the side, on playing softball in the National Mall, you meet people who you wouldn't normally come across in your daily life, and you have a better appreciation for the complexity of individuals, the challenges that they face, and it gives you, I think, a better appreciation as a manager in understanding the whole person that you're working with. So it's not just what they're doing for the company, but what they have going on in their lives as well.
Let's talk about a specific example of what you just described. Earlier in your career, you worked in the food stamp program. What is a misconception or a stereotype that most people have about people on food stamps that's absolutely not true?
I've long believed that individuals who are dependent on public benefit supports probably do a better job than many of us in budgeting their money, because there's so little capability, quite frankly, for many of us day to day, to give a second thought to that extra latte or what have you. But for those individuals, every penny matters. They become incredibly capable of stretching the limited means that they have. I have tremendous respect for folks in that position.
Would you give us the web address, please, for the health services segment, Maximus?
Sure. You can find us at www.maximus.com.
Would you spell that for us?
www.maximus.com.
Thanks very much. We've been speaking with Bruce Caswell, President and General Manager of the Health Services segment, Maximus. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Phil Horegi of Sabre Systems and Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders like Bruce. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Lisa Norell.
And Lisa, who are you with?
My company is Energize Growth.
Tell us about Energize Growth.
Mike, we help business-to-business companies grow market share by growing employee and customer mind share. We're celebrating our 10-year anniversary, and over those 10 years, companies like Adobe Systems, Microsoft, and Wells Fargo have implemented our tools and systems.
But you're here to talk about something else today, actually a very special event on March 22nd.
Yes. On March 22nd, I will be the featured speaker and author at the Tower Club. And it's from 8 to 9:30 in the morning. My session is called Four Strategies to Energize Growth and Thrive in the Recovery. And I'm inviting listeners to check it out and join us.
Why is the topic important for people to come and listen?
Well, in the past, Mike, your company could survive with a pulse. But today, you can only thrive if you have a plan, especially a customer-focused plan that is really, really focused on helping you build a solid marketing platform for growth.
Who should attend this event?
These are business-to-business companies who are growing and are probably successful, but you know, they may have hit that wall and said, we're not sure how to scale the next wall of growth. We need some fresh ideas. So we're going to have three key things we're going to make sure that people walk away with. Number one, fresh new marketing ideas. Two, capitalizing on hidden opportunities. And three, foster innovative thinking with customers' involvement.
What's the web address, please, Lisa?
They can register for the session by calling Kelsey at the Tower Club, which is area code 703-761-4250. Or you can go to my website, energizegrowth.com, and just contact me and I'll send you the details.
We've been speaking with Lisa Norell of Energize Growth, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney, and we are very thrilled to introduce to you our next guest. His name is Gore Bolton, and Gore is the founder and CEO of Bolton Brands. So, Gore, welcome to the show, and tell us, what is Bolton Brands?
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Bolton Brands focuses on seed stage and startup companies that need expertise more than capital.
Okay, what is seed stage?
Basically, it's where somebody has an idea, or they maybe have a couple customers, but they think that this business is scalable and growable, but they don't really know what to do next.
Okay, and you help them in what way?
We help them in a variety of ways. We can help them find capital partners. Most people think they need to raise capital. Most of the time, we just help them raise revenues and figure out how to get strategic sales closed.
In the green room, you used a babysitting service as an example. Tell us about that and maybe some other.
Well, I have four kids, so it resonated with me. So it was one of those moments where I go to a lot of meetup groups from meetup.com and entrepreneurial groups. And so I started one in a community that did not have any entrepreneurial groups. And one of the entrepreneurs started an online babysitting service and needs a lot of different type of help. And so what we do in cases like that is really get to know what they're up to, because at the end of the day, when you invest your time, that's your greatest risk, because that you can't get back.
How many companies do you have in your portfolio?
We have about a dozen right now, and we've got about six that we're in talks with, and we've got about a funnel of about 100. So it's a pretty fertile field right now with the way the economy is.
And you founded this company when?
I started my original company in 1999, and it has morphed into this as a result of strategic planning and staying away from the economic disasters.
See, now I thought your original company was a lemonade stand.
Well, the lemonade stand, and actually my very first profitable company was a print shop company in sixth grade.
And well, we're going to get back to that, but tell us about growing up on a farm and having to fix things.
Yeah, so one of the things that I learned very early on is when you're isolated on a farm, and you're in the middle of whatever it is, whether it's gathering hay or cleaning stalls or whatever, when something breaks, you have to fix it. And you may not, if you're too young to drive, you can't drive to the parts store, or you may need to fabricate something. And so a lot of times that's where the engineering skill set comes out to really make something work.
You've had a very interesting career. You're originally trained as an engineer, but you mentioned you don't want to work with companies when you have to keep timesheets. How do you mesh those two disciplines?
Well, I'm hoping somebody else collects the timesheets, because that's not going to be my role. And I make that very clear early on. And what that does is it keeps expectations aligned so that they understand the value I want to bring to the table. It makes it more interesting for me. But then from the standpoint of the partner or the company that I'm working with, they also understand that there's going to be other operational requirements that we're going to have to make sure get filled. So it's an easy analogy that I have found for people that I partner with to understand where I draw the line as to what I'm going to spend my time doing.
Let's go back to the farm for a minute. You said that if something was broke, you might have to fabricate something.
That's right.
You were fabricating things at what age?
Oh, very early on. I mean, with my dad on the farm, my older brother, my brother was what I consider a genius mechanic. He could pretty much make anything run. I mean, literally with baling twine and bubble gum sometimes. And so we really, anything from metal to welding to just anything. One of my first hobbies was remote control airplanes, because you would, you build them from scratch. And so that's how I got into engineering, was that first hobby.
And your engineering career and your business career really took off with the Commodore 64.
Yeah, the Commodore 64 in sixth grade, that was the Christmas gift that kept on giving. And I'll never forget, by Valentine's Day, I was asking, my mom used to give me lunch money, obviously, in sixth grade, but by Valentine's Day, I was asking my mom if she needed lunch money.
For those people who don't know what a Commodore 64 is, what is it? And give us more detail about the business in sixth
Commodore,
grade.
Yeah, Commodore 64 was basically one of the first home computers that offered color printing and programs like Print Shop Deluxe. That's what it was. It was one of the first home computers that you could use.
And you had one in sixth grade.
I had one in sixth grade.
What'd you do with it? Just kind of mess around and fool around to play games?
Yeah, I mean, everything from basic programming to the business cards and the printing was really what grabbed me as far as an application. And that was some of the first software applications where you weren't writing all your own code and everything in BASIC or some other language.
You mentioned you have continual curiosity. Does that help you sort through the companies you analyze?
Yeah, it really does, because there's the language of business, which is the finances. And so the language that you have to follow is a pretty set standard at this point. We know a lot about everything from finances to raising money to all those types of things. But you have to stay curious as to what their unique selling proposition is and where their value is. And if that can't become a compelling message that ties people to action to actually spend money on your product, then what you've really got is something really cool that's kind of a party favor almost. It's not really a business at that point.
You mentioned, and you've had a very successful life, but it hasn't been nonstop success. You mentioned something that I thought was fabulous. You said you had to rebrand and repropel yourself. Why don't you let our audience hear about that?
So I was very fortunate back in 99 when I founded my company. As a trained engineer, we did a lot of engineering and permit work in the housing industry. And so we recognized that bubble was about to burst in about 2005, 2006. And so we hit all of the backup alarms, warning alarms, and everything. But the iceberg still came, so to speak. And I watched a lot of companies close. We had to lay a lot of people off. And we had to basically adjust to a segment of the market that has just been decimated. And so when you actually lay off a last group of people, I'll never forget the day, there were eight people left in that particular company. And they looked like Custer's last stand. And they were tattered and torn, and they looked like they had absolutely just been through everything they could. And it actually got to the point where I think I gave them a sense of relief that it was over with, that they could go on and find something else to do.
It sounds as if that was an emotional experience for you.
Oh, yeah, it was horrible. I mean, my passion is creating opportunities for things. It's not putting them to rest. It's not ending them.
Where did you get the energy or the strength to repropel yourself?
It's a couple different things. I focused a lot inwardly. I've done a couple very basic things. One of my belief systems is that when you're knocked down, you have to get back up. But then one of the best things to do when you're first back up is help somebody else up. And there's a lot of energy and power you get in helping other people. And so that's been a lot of my time. One of the biggest shifts was I was introduced to a couple of educational programs locally that I participated in that really dealt with the whole thing of dealing with past successes and failures. A lot of people don't realize success can be a bigger barrier to future efforts than failure, because failure, you failed. Yeah. But success and staying on top is sometimes even harder to keep up with.
A moment ago, you mentioned about getting knocked down and getting back up again. Is that why you didn't play D1 basketball?
It's kind of interesting. There was an eligibility issue that came up. When you're 17 years old going through that, one of the things that that I have a firm belief of after going through that was that a lot of the parents of student athletes, without having to have representation, and there's a lot of things we could talk about around that topic. But for me personally, what it meant was that I couldn't control my own destiny. It was in the hands of somebody else in order to participate in a program.
Let's give a little more context to that. So you're a senior in high school. You're good enough to play D1 basketball.
I'm getting recruited. I have bought shoe boxes full of letters. I'm going on recruiting trips. I mean, I'm living the dream as a senior in high school.
And what happened?
I tore my ankles up playing football instead of basketball. And so my basketball coach was very disappointed, obviously. But I never really saw the full impact until the phone stopped ringing and I realized that the best thing I had was to go get an engineering degree. And so I had to basically make a decision very early in life that when something that you really wanted to do doesn't necessarily work out, that doesn't mean you just give up.
How'd you do that?
Well, I think my mother was pretty stubborn about whether I was going to go to school or not. I mean, she was more interested in me getting an engineering degree than she was me playing basketball. So I think to a certain extent, there was always that kind of smirk that I would get that, you know, yeah. She'd rather that happen for me. But what it taught me was that, you know, whatever you find yourself doing, give it what you got.
You had a quote in the green room, and I'm going to quote it right now. Nothing is there until someone speaks an idea. What does that have to do with your life experiences, and what does that mean?
Well, what it means is basically everything starts from nothing. No idea is conceived without a thought. It has to come from somewhere. And then until that thought is shared through some power of language, however we communicate it, whether we write it down, whether we scribble it on rocks, whether we communicate it verbally, whether we, you know, sign language, whatever form of communication we use. But until that idea is conveyed to a sense that other people can feel, touched, moved, inspired by that, they really don't feel like they can engage with you. And so once you have that connection on whatever opportunity is that exists, you can then advance the ball.
So what does that have to do with you?
Well, what it has to do with me is in order to get people engaged, a startup is very, very hard. You're dealing with, and they call it sweat equity for a reason. You're dealing with ideas. You're dealing with time. You're dealing with, should I get a job? How do I pay my bills? You're dealing with all those bootstrap issues with a startup. And so unless there's a compelling force that's pulling you forward to a greater vision, a bigger idea, you're not going to get it done. You have to be committed to it.
Would you give us the web address for Bolton Brands, please?
Sure. I can be found at www.gorebolton.com, and happy to talk to anybody that's interested.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Gore Bolton. Gore is the founder and CEO of Bolton Brands. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is...
My name's Paul Smith.
And Paul, who are you with?
I am a benefits consultant with the Potomac Companies.
What does the Potomac Companies do?
Well, we help our client partners control the future costs of their health care.
What do you mean by future costs?
Well, you know, as time, every business executive, one of their top functions in any company as either an owner or a top executive is to control costs at their company. Well, healthcare is no different. You have to look at these things. You have to do things to control these costs.
Yeah. Why are you guys so good at doing it?
Well, what we've done and what our clients have been telling us is as we look at the trends over a 5 to 7 year period, a given company might see their rates doubling. And what a lot of executives don't realize is that doubling, if they're, let's say they're paying $1 million a year for premium, goes to $2 million, but they're going to spend $3.5 million to get there. So it's not just a linear thing. It's more of a exponential thing.
I hear many business owners say that rising health care costs are a fait accompli. There's just nothing they can do about it. Is that true?
Well, that's why they'd want to work with us and find out. There are things that can be done. There's a lot of things that you have to do. There's a lot of information out there, and that's what we help them do.
In just a few words, is there a success story that you can share with us?
Well, it's an ongoing thing. It's savings over time. There's nothing that anyone's going to do as a shotgun approach and go bang and drop your rates significantly and keep them there. It's what are you doing? How are you monitoring? How are you looking at everything?
If someone wanted to contact you and learn more, what would they do?
www.potomacco.com.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Paul Smith. Paul's with the Potomac Companies. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Phil Horeggi of Saber Systems and Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And we are excited to introduce you to our next guest, John Abeles. John is the founder, president, and CEO of System One. So, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And what is System One?
System One is a consulting firm that is a boutique firm supplying information assurance, critical infrastructure, and cybersecurity. Basically, what we do is make sure that the information, the intellectual property in all the firms, law firms, banks, medical, medical firms, as people move into the information age, stays secure so that no one takes your personal information.
So as I do business with my bank, let's say online, what do you do for me?
Well, basically, we help design the policies for the financial system, for Treasury and some others, to make sure their information is safeguarded on computer systems, on technology. But a lot of what we do is not about technology.
Yeah.
It's about people. It's about behavior.
Got it. And we're going to talk more about that in just a moment. How long have you been doing this?
Well, we've been doing the critical infrastructure and cybersecurity for about 12 years. System One itself goes back to the late 80s. We've been a firm that's been evolving. What I put System One together to do originally was solve problems for greater society. So we worked in the energy sector. We've helped reorganize companies. We've worked with major government agencies, including the White House. We've done a lot of really interesting kind of leading edge types of development of new concepts and new ideas.
Yeah. Why did you found a company?
Well, I worked for a couple of multinationals, and I had worked in, I'd worked in the United States. We had clients in Europe. We had clients in the Pacific Rim. The problem with most of the multinationals that I worked for was they were profit-oriented. And while profit isn't bad, that became the driver. It was a numbers game, so you had to have numbers. What System One was designed to do was take advantage of the intellectual capacity of a lot of senior-level people who had retired from their first or second-generation types of jobs. They were ex-military, intelligence agencies, private sector people who were a little bit older, or had a lot of experience, that we could use their minds and their experience to synthesize new ways of solving problems.
These folks aren't interested in making a profit?
Of course they are, and they're compensated that way. But the whole idea is that what we do is we try to come up with new concepts to help move things forward. For example, today, everyone talks about cloud computing. We're looking at the security of clouds because everyone is moving their information into the cloud. Mobile technology is another thing. Everyone wants information on demand, wherever and whenever they want it. We help make that more secure from a policy standpoint.
When we asked you the question about why found the company in the green room, you went all the way back to your parents, actually. Tell us about your parents.
Okay. I came from a very interesting background. Both my parents were kids from the Depression. Both of them came from, I wouldn't say, well-off backgrounds. My father started working when he was 16. He worked in Nam's department store in the deli counter, primarily because he didn't have a lot of money for food, so if he worked at Nam's, they'd give him the ends of the bologna, the salami, the cheese, and he could have that for lunch, so it kept them fed. My mother came from a widowed, her father died when he was in his early 40s, and she was left with a widowed mother who was a New York City school teacher. So they were both brought up. My mother was artistically oriented. My father was business oriented. He started his own business when he was about early 20s. And built up a wholesale meat business in New York. And so education was actually very important to them. I was the first college educated out of the three kids in my family.
You got into these systems in 1989, which was pre-computer, pre-everything. What gave you the foresight to do that?
Well, quite honestly, originally what I did is hired smart people. And we solved problems. Most of our problems were focused on the government. Most of our work that had been private sector before was in reorganizing big companies. So a lot of the electric utilities that had gotten to problems with regulators and safety, like nuclear plants, making sure they were safe, making sure the environment was protected, those are issues that we had actually worked on. One of our first government projects was working for the Secretary of Energy, restoring confidence in Department of Energy in their nuclear safety approach.
Now, one of the things you had mentioned about the uniqueness of your company is the way that you work as a team, and maybe it touches a little bit on the culture that you've developed at System One. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
And maybe how that was influenced by maybe some of the things you observed as a child.
Well, I watched how my family worked. I was in a family business, which means that it's kind of, I'll use the phrase, asses and elbows. Everyone does what they need to do. They work together. They lead by example. And so when I start to look at that, everyone was accountable for what they had to do. My aunt ran the back office portion of the company. My father was sales, and my uncle, Manny, was the guy who did operations. So when I look at the triumvirate of how they worked together, they always didn't get along well together, but they brokered solutions. And a lot of the clients came in, you probably don't know, used to come in off big trailers, and it would be hanging on hooks that would come over an overhead pulley system. And then as the meat would come off, the customers would all argue which piece would be theirs, because no two pieces of meat were exactly alike, the butchers, the restaurants, that sort of thing. So it was kind of, you learned how to broker solutions.
You went for older people in the 90s and the first part of this decade, whereas everyone seems to think that Gen X, Gen Y are the answer. What gave you that insight?
Well, the real issue is that while you have technology, you can have a lot of point solutions. It's not about point solutions. It's about creating a secure environment, changing behavior so security is incorporated into how you accomplish your mission or deliver your services. And so to do that, you need a mix of older people. A lot of what we do is work Socratically. And really, it's interesting because we have some of our clients who love watching us work and some don't. But what typically happens is we're posed a problem. How do we solve this? And we look at the technologies, we look at behaviors, we look at the culture in the organization, because you mentioned culture before, and we try to come up with a solution that marries the culture and the technology and all the pieces together. In today's environment, this means how do we do it at the lowest cost also? So, I mean, there's a big push from the government to minimize some of the IT costs, and part of what we do is build that into how we do business.
You know, you sort of like allude to another, but what is the importance of wisdom in an organization?
That's a tough question.
Here's why. Like, you talk about some of these, you know, young Gen Yers who are, you know, tech savvy, but they don't necessarily may have the wisdom to have the solutions and maybe to have the perspective, you know, some of the long view.
And actually what we've done in the company is the company's gone through a seminal shift in the last 2 years. Previously, we had basically only senior people. Now we've started to bring in and select younger people that we're actually mentoring through the process so they can learn the discipline and learn to challenge thinking so that we can come up with new solutions and to come up with patterns that will last.
What led you to that? Because it's hard to change how you run a business when you're growing and been successful, which you have been. But you've seen been willing to stand back, look at this, and said, I need to change.
Well, you know, the whole thing is, some people have called this an operational think tank because, you know, kind of our catchphrase is small numbers of smart people achieving great success. So we're handling things like cloud, and we're handling things like, you know, mobile technology and how you do that more securely and how do you do it more cheaply. And so, you know, the young people have a really good handle on some of the technology. Some of the older people understand really some of the constraints in government and in the private sector, and the marriage of the two gives you a better outlook. So, you know, you say, what made us change? And the real question is, we are forward-thinking people. We have to use the same level of examination internally as we do externally for our clients.
Well, you use the word change. So do you view yourself as change agents for your clients?
We actually are. In a lot of cases, we have acted as changing culture because we're not dealing with a technology issue. Today, everything rides on technology. So the board of directors of a big company, if you're a law firm and you have intellectual property, or you're doing research and there are billions of dollars of research the United States does each year, a lot of that walks out the door because people steal it.
Your company keeps a very low profile. Why?
Well, at one point we were asked by some clients not even to have a website. I'm walking at a sensitive issue, let's just say. But so our website doesn't really say much about the company, but you know, people who need to get to us have found ways to find us.
One thing you can speak freely about is that you are, in your words, an ethics-based company. What does that mean?
Well, you know, System One was set up when I first started System One. I was working for multinationals, and I had actually a small company with someone else doing some doing, I don't know. I do know. But basically helping electric utilities move from a position where they were in monopolies into a free market. And a lot of those electric utilities had significant challenges. So they brought in recovery teams. And I was part of those recovery teams as a young guy. So,
yeah. Would you give us the web address, please, for System 1? And I know the web is probably not going to tell us a whole lot, but what's the website?
Sure. The website is www.syst1.com. Sam, Yankee Sam, Tango 1.com.
All right, give it to us one more time. For those non-military people, give it to us one more time.
It's www.syst1.com.
Perfect. Thanks very much. We've been speaking with John Ablis. John is the founder, president, and CEO of a company you've probably never heard of, and they like it that way, System 1. I'd like to thank my two co-hosts, Phil Horegi of Saber Systems and Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan Ingersoll Rooney for helping me with the interview. Please check us out on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders like John. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight.
Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380. Or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And Ed and I are very happy to introduce to you our final guest of the day. Her name is Maria Proestu. And Maria is the co-founder, president, and CEO of Delta Resources. So, Maria, welcome to the show. And tell us, what is Delta Resources?
Delta Resources is a professional services firm providing program management, engineering, financial management, and IT solutions to DoD customers.
So how is the everyday American better off by what you do?
Well, one example of some of the services that we provide is we help the Marine Corps and the DoD's Joint Program Office for the MRAP vehicle, which is a vehicle that was created specifically to help protect soldiers and Marines from IED attacks, those explosive devices that blow up our troops overseas. And our group helps support the testing. We help write the plans and make sure that the vehicles, when they're delivered, do what they're supposed to do.
You called it an MRAP. That's an acronym. Can you slowly tell us, what does the acronym stand for?
It is the Mine Resistant Ambush Protected Vehicle. So it's a vehicle that protects you from mines and ambushes.
And your role with that vehicle is what again?
We provide support to the government office that tests those vehicles before they're deployed.
Wow, that is very important work. Thank you very much for doing it. How big or small is Delta Resources?
We are a mid-sized firm, about $40 million in annual revenues, about 280 employees. Yeah.
And Delta Resources has been around for how long?
We're 11 years old.
Okay. And why did you co-found a company?
One of the big reasons we founded Delta Resources is we had young children. And we wanted to have a company that would allow us to have a flexible work environment. We could provide services to our customers and also have time for our families.
So you can own a business, run the business, and still have time for your family.
Yes, that was what we constructed as our business model.
Did it work?
Yes, it's been very successful. In fact, we were, I think, at the cutting edge of the telework, remote home office movement. When we started 11 years ago, it wasn't really heard of to have remote access to email or servers and be able to provide documents to the government through electronic means.
Well, you're in the DOD space. You're a young woman starting a company. How that seems, let's say, not an obvious choice to get into that space. How did you get into that?
Well, you know, I've been very lucky and fortunate to work with some really smart people. And when I got my master's degree up at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy in Boston, I worked with military officers. And we established a very tight network. And one of the naval officers said, "We need contract support." And my answer was, "Well, what the heck's that?" I've always been interested in national security policy and Department of Defense military issues, but never really had a means to get in there. But this friend of mine said, "Hey, we need help." And I went in and learned the job kind of on the spot in the Pentagon for 6 years before we started the company.
Wow. Tell us about Mom and Dad.
My parents are immigrants from Cyprus, and they moved to Ohio in the late 60s.
Why'd they do that?
They came for mostly economic opportunity, but there was also some political turmoil in Cyprus.
What was going on?
Well, there was some civil war, some problems between the Greek majority population. I'm Greek of descent, and there was a Turkish minority. And actually, in 1974, Turkey invaded Cyprus. So they left just kind of before all of that happened.
What were your parents doing in Cyprus, and how did that translate to what they were doing in the United States?
Really no bearing. My parents were in the medical profession. They were both nurses, and then they immigrated to Ohio to be with my father's family, and they were in the restaurant business, and so my dad went into the restaurant business.
That must have been quite disruptive of them and scary. How did that affect them, and how did that affect you?
Well, I think they definitely clung to getting involved in their community and taking leadership roles in the community because they were an isolated, you know, small group. So that was a big thing for them to get involved with that. For me, you know, I saw how hard it was for them to acclimate into a new culture and how much harder they had to work to have opportunities. And they really focused for me and for my family, for my sister, as well on education. Education was very important and is very important in our family. And so that was one of the things they wanted us to have, the opportunities that they could not have. And so that's
You've spoken a lot about family in the interview. Tell us about your husband.
Well, my husband passed away in 1998, and I was 6 weeks pregnant, and so that was a very traumatic thing for me, and I had to make a decision if I wanted to stay in Washington, D.C. area or if I wanted to move home to Ohio, and I made the decision to stay here and keep working because I wanted to do something that mattered. I wanted to continue to make a difference while I was raising my daughter, you know, that actually then drove a couple years later when I started the company. I wanted time with my daughter, and I still wanted to do something important. So that was a big part of it.
You mentioned several times you wanted to do something that matters. Where did that come from?
You know, a lot of that did come from my family wanting to have an influence and make, you know, the sacrifices they made because they probably could have been more successful, you know, professionally, had they stayed in Cyprus, but they came here to provide more opportunity for myself and my sister. So we took on a lot of that on ourselves, and that made me want to work harder and do something important.
What was the hardest part of losing your husband? And what was your husband's name?
His name was Savas.
What was the hardest part of losing Savas?
Well, obviously, you lose, you know, your partner. You lose half your income. You lose sort of that sounding board and that security net, you know, that And for me also, it was a little bit of a loss of innocence, because up until that point, everything I had tried, I'd been very successful at. Everything kind of went my way. And so this was something that was a truly devastating thing that you had to kind of pick yourself up and move forward.
Well, was it a difficult decision to stay here as opposed to moving back to Ohio?
Yeah, it was very difficult. I mean, I had to weigh my own personal needs, what was best for my daughter, and what I thought long-term would be important.
Well, you've built a very successful company over the last 10 years. Where do you want to take it now? What's the next step for you?
Well, we'd like to continue to do right by our employees, and that's one thing that we're seeing in the current market that is really something that we've got to stay focused on like a laser beam, because the market is difficult. The competition is stiffer than it's ever been in the DoD services environment. So as we move forward, we want to grow and continue to grow. I've always, you know, I've never been satisfied where I'm at. I always want to keep on moving forward. And at the same time, I want to make sure I do it by staying true to the culture that we built for the company.
How would you describe your culture?
It's very family-oriented. Everyone tells me that, and we are definitely committed to having a great work-life balance. I was very lucky a couple years ago. I was invited to the White House to speak about work-life balance and workplace flexibility.
Tell us why 9/11 was so devastating to you in particular.
Well, we started the company in October 2000. So it was myself, my co-founder, Kevin Mills, and our third co-founder, Bob Elseth, Lieutenant Commander in the Navy Reserves. And Bob was actually serving in the Pentagon on 9/11 as part of his reserve responsibilities. So we lost one of our three legs of our stool that day.
How'd you deal with that?
It was very tough. You know, Kevin and I had to decide if we wanted to keep going or if we wanted to just stop this little company experiment that we had started. And we made the decision. It was important not only for us but to his memory to keep going.
You had two major decision points in your life, both attached to the death of someone. How do you go about making decisions like that? What drives you? What compass do you use?
There's definitely a piece of those decisions that are to prove myself in spite of this setback, I can still succeed, I can overcome. So there's definitely a bit of that drives me. And then there's also the honoring the memory and honoring the legacy of those people that we keep going forward.
Yeah. Savas and Bob probably think what about what you've been able to accomplish?
Well, Bob had a fun saying he used to say to us all. He'd say, "How cool is that?" Every time we talk about it, he'd say, "How cool is that?" So he would say, "How cool is that?"
Well, speaking at the White House must have been quite cool. Tell us a little bit about what you said and the event.
Well, it was a neat event. They brought small business leaders from all sorts of industries together to talk about how you structure a business, what kind of cultural things that you do to help encourage workplace flexibility and programs. And so I was able to share our experiences and how we could, in a military, very male-dominated structured environment, still be able to promote workplace flexibility.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Give us the web address for Delta Resources, please.
www.deltaresources.com.
So it's spelled just as it sounds, Delta Resources.
Yes.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Maria Proestu. Maria is the co-founder, president, and CEO of Delta Resources. I'd like to thank all of our guests today, including Bruce Caswell. Bruce is the president and general manager of the health services segment, Maximus. John Ablis, founder, president, and CEO of System One. Gore Bolton, founder, CEO of Bolton Brands. And, of course, most recently, Maria Proestu, co-founder, president, and CEO of Delta Resources. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Ed Alera of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney, as well as Phil Horeggi of Saber Systems for helping me with the interviews. Most of all, we'd like to thank our listeners. If it were not for you, we wouldn't even have a radio show. So thank you so very much for listening. Thank you to the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce for hosting us today. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. This has been your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. Again, thank you so much for listening, and until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility.